Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The man is complex, but brilliant. And the story is going from lost boy to national treasure. And I think it's only something you can do in the sort of 20th century, early 21st century.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bowen. It was over a delicious lunch, nearly 3.5 years ago now, that Paul Beaver first told me about the biography he was working on about his friend Eric Brown, Winkle to the World, and arguably the greatest test pilot that's ever lived. The book is finally out, and it's fantastic. I really enjoyed it. So I grabbed this opportunity to sit down with Paul, and we just have a chat in this episode about his friendship with Winkle, his incredible wife, Lynn, and just tell some stories about the man and delve into the book as well. We don't go chapter and verse. We don't start talking overly technical because the book is a very human book looking at a complex man, and Paul's done a great job pulling it apart. So I'm going to stop waffling. Ladies and gentlemen, the fabulous Paul Beaver. So like we were saying on the phone, really, I adored it. Thank you for letting me read it early.
Huge pleasure.
It's considering, I think we've been chatting about this for 3 years now, haven't we?
Well, I've been actually, if I think about it, it's been 6 years in the gestation. COVID didn't help, of course, mainly because Penguin, like all businesses, sort of slowed down or changed direction or whatever. But I think the key was that once I started doing the research, I found it wasn't a simple job. It wasn't just rehashing wings on my sleeve. It actually required a lot of due diligence in going into primary sources. So therefore, it was a six-year project. I think that, you know, the timing actually was right. I should have known the timing was going to be right. I should have known it was going to be easier than just dashing off a book like Spitfire Evolution, which took a month. I had to grow up quickly.
I think I've whittled everything down in this book to just one question. Mm-hmm. You knew Eric for 40 years, mm-hmm. and he was quite keen for you to do his biography after he passed, of course. What did the things that you found in your research tell you about your friend that you didn't know?
I found out a lot I didn't know about Eric. I found that, and I never called him Winkle. I always called him Eric. The very first time I met him in November 1978, I think it was, I said, "What do I call you, sir?" And before he could answer, his wife, Lynn, said, who had the most beautiful Northern Irish accent, she said, "Paul, he's called Eric. None of this other W stuff." So he was always Eric to me. And although other people, including various first sea lords of Horse Corden Winkle. He was very much Eric. So the key question, what do I find out? Oh, Matt, I found out so much. He was more than his autobiography gives out. The man is complex, but brilliant. And the story is going from lost boy to national treasure. And I think it's only something you can do in the sort of 20th century, early 21st century. I mean, I just think it's an amazing story, and it reflects our time and our age and the attitude that people have. So let's get to the nub. Should we get to the nub of this? I mean,
let's do it.
The first thing I did was I got his service record, what the Navy called his S206. And that gave me a different date of birth and a different place of birth. And I thought, this is interesting. He's a year younger than I thought. So I then said to his family, you don't happen to have a copy of his birth certificate? And they said, well, we've got this. It's a bit ragged, but yes, have a look at this. They scanned it, sent it to me. And I looked at it and I thought, there's a lot wrong with this birth certificate. So I was able to send it to the registrar in Alwa in Scotland and say, could you kindly have a look at this for me, please? Within 30 minutes, she came back and said, we've had a look. He's, of course, a great Scot. And, of course, about 2 years before, he'd just been declared the greatest Scot of the 20th century. Sorry about that, Mr. Salmon and Miss Sturgeon. And she said, we can count at least 27 alterations. We can count probably 5 absolute forgeries. And I have to tell you that this person was born in London. So a bit more due diligence, find some of the family who then turn out not to be the family because guess what? Eric's adopted. And there were, at the time I was doing the research in 2016-17, there were still a number of people alive who remember the stories from the 1930s. So in a nutshell, Eric is born at the Salvation Army Hospital in Hackney. He's a Cockney. He's not a Scot. And he was put on a train by the National Child Adoption Agency, no longer exists, to Scotland, where there were no laws about adoption until about 1936. A notice was put in the Scotsman, which said, families of good repute might be interested in the NCAA train arriving at Waverley Station on the, I can't remember the date now, in February 1920. And Euphemia and Robert Brown, a childless couple living in Leith, he was a journeyman tailor, they were tipped off by a relative who worked in the station. And they wanted a boy. And when they arrived, there was only one cot left. There's only one little boy screaming his head off. Nobody taking any interest. That was Eric Brown. Or that was Eric. Surname unknown. Mother Dorothy, no father's name. And from there, I had to start building the story. And so the first thing, of course, you do is you look at all that and you ring the family and you say, did you know? And his son, Glenn, said, no, of course not. No, everything is in wings on my sleeve is what we believe. I said, well, I'm going to do a bit more due diligence on this. So I get his father's service record and find his father was not a pilot in the Royal Flying Corps or in the Royal Air Force. And all this retired wing commander or retired, rather, flight lieutenant, retired squadron leader on various certificates, all completely made up. So there's a huge amount of that. So the next question, I think, is does that in some way take away anything of Eric's greatness? And the answer is no. Actually, to me, it adds to it. In the 1930s, we might have been horrified. But to me now, today, I look at that and I go, wow, foundling on Waverley Station, Edinburgh, to the greatest test pilot in the world, I think, without any doubt, certainly our greatest pilot. You know, the records speak for themselves, 487 types, all checked, all verified. 2,407 jet landings, checked, verified. 2,271 launches, checked, verified. Time in Germany before the war, meeting Udet, checked, verified. Going through all of these things, the only thing I can't quite place him, and I say this in the book, at the Olympic Games in 1936, because I've got his passports, I've got his school reports, I've got his service record, I've got his father's service record, I've got addresses, I've been through the various documents. The Scots are brilliant when it comes to keeping records. They're superb. So I've got all the school material. I've talked to the school. I've talked to the Schloss in Zalem in Germany. Found that he actually wasn't going there in 1939. He was actually going to the Élysée Supérieure at Metz in France. He just took a roundabout route to get there in his MG. Great photographs, an MG with a swastika on the bonnet and a Union flag. not stupid. Identify yourself as British, but you know, being acquiescent to the system. You know, that's what you did. Interestingly, the MG's registration starts SS. Just purely, you know, you just start looking at these things. And then I get some lucky breaks. I find some people who knew about the student swap in 1939 between Britain and Germany, which allowed him to leave. Can you imagine if Eric Brown had been interned on the 3rd of September 1939 and had never been in the war? We would have never had that great test pilot. And the fact he went to the Royal Navy, the fact that he started off as a naval seaman second class, so I'm really sorry, the good burghers of Edinburgh. Your statue at Edinburgh Airport is somewhat misleading in its in what's written there. You know, you've got all of these things, Matt. You go through, which I think makes two things. It makes a biography compelling because the research has been done, but it makes the character even more compelling. And you know, it's who didn't he meet in the 20th century, you know, every just about everyone. And there's this great line, which I don't actually think is in the book in the end. I think it was edited out, but it was dinner party 2009. Phil O'Dell and a few other test pilots and me. You'd have to be either a display pilot or a test pilot to be there. I only qualify on the display pilot bit. And I'm sitting next to Eric. The conversation dips, as conversations do at dinner parties. It's only 12 of us. And Eric says, "Of course, the second time I met Hitler." To which Phil O'Dell falls off his chair almost and goes, "What do you mean the second time? What was the first?" And, you know, I wanted to call the biography "The Second Time I Met Hitler." But Penguin thought that was more for an autobiography rather than a biography. But and it's just fun stuff like that. And slowly, slowly, in the last few years, probably 2013 to 2016, I saw a lot of Eric. I got more and more out of him. The whole Civil War thing in Spain. Really, really interesting. Can't really firm that up other than entries in his flying logbook. And odd notes. So I've got 12 cases of notes. I've got pictures, photo albums. I've got memorabilia, badges, all sorts of stuff that I've been going through and using. So I'm pretty sure I know Eric Brown better than anyone, certainly better than anyone in his family, probably better than anyone who actually served with him, because I've delved into the man. That's the whole point of writing a biography. It isn't a list of aeroplanes flown. It's not Wings on My Sleeve. It is absolutely the biography of Eric Melrose Brown. Of course, originally christened Eric Brown, the Melrose was introduced at school because there was another Eric Brown. And there are a lot of Browns around. In the Borders, and he's a boy from Gala Shields, not Melrose, Gala Shields. The people in Gala say, Brown is not a common surname. It's just a well-liked one. So lots of people have it. And I love that, that sort of sense of humor. I mean, he's definitely Gala Shields' boy. He's Edinburgh's boy as well, and the university and the Royal High School. So, yeah, there's a lot there, Matt. And I've rambled a bit, but I have to tell you, I could talk for hours about Eric.
Well, I'm going to keep you for at least one of those hours and get as much of it out as I can. I think you've nailed it with what you've just said and with the book is Eric the man is far more interesting than a lot of the things that he managed to do in the aircraft. The technicalities are fascinating, but the man himself really came to life because I never had the pleasure of meeting him. I've only seen the interviews, read his book, and chatted to good people like yourself about him. But there was something about reading that first chapter about him being an orphan and myself being the son of a Bernardo's boy. A lot of things clicked into place, especially later in his career with his irascibility with senior figures as well.
Irascible. Absolutely.
There was a lot of it made sense. And I think understanding that about him, that he had this inane need to push forward, I think, that sort of explains so much. And perhaps with the stories of the family of, his father, a squadron leader, things like that didn't chime quite right. But then once you start unpicking those layers, like you said, a lot of things start slotting into place.
I think, only child, I think no doubt needed to prove himself. I don't think he knew until much later in his life that he was adopted. I think the changes in the birth certificate may well have been, and actually this isn't in the book, but it may well be in the second edition, which I hope there'll be, is that he was selected to play rugby as an international under 17 or under 16 for the Scottish Rugby Union. And I think in 1936, that sort of period, you needed to be Scottish by birth. I can't see any other reason for doing it. He certainly didn't need it in the Navy. I mean, the Navy knew all his naval papers say born 1920, not 1919, as he would say, born London. Even his early passports say 1920 in London. It all gets very confusing when you start to pile them up. It was good to find out that he'd learned to fly under the civil system in 1938 down in Westmorling in Kent. I was able to track down his instructor, who taught the lady who taught him aerobatics, so important when you're going to be a fighter pilot. A lot of good stuff there. He didn't learn to fly at Edinburgh University, the Air Squadron, or anything like that, mainly because there wasn't the university air squadron, which is a good reason for not flying there. The air units, there were two that were sitting in Cambridge before the war. By about 1941, I think Edinburgh had got one, but by that stage, 1941, he was a fighter pilot. He's an ace, by the way, as well. That's pretty cool. He never, ever called himself an ace. He was probably the most decorated pilot. And then we get on to the whole thing of, so why did he not get a knighthood? And that's quite complex. That's to do with his nature, the way he rubbed up the civil service, the way he upset Dennis Healey, calling the Secretary of State for Defense in a minuted meeting, a communist, even though it was correct because, of course, Healey had been a member of the Communist Party of Great Britain when he was some low-deck person in the Navy. Just doesn't go well. It was Healey who stopped his next job after Lossiemouth in 1970 because he'd been slated to be the naval advisor in Washington, the British Defence Staff, where he could have continued the Fleet Air Arm connection with the US Navy. I mean, the US Navy and the Fleet Air Arm, or Naval Air Command in America and the Fleet Air Arm, were for 30 years hand in glove. And a lot of that is to do with Eric and his personality and what he did, you know, selecting the Phantom and things like that.
And I think that's the other thing that sort of jumps out is those liaison roles. He manages so much better than, say, as in command of squadrons and things like that. I wanted to ask, as you knew her, how much do you think that was down to Lynn? Because she sounds the most remarkable lady that in those sort of diplomatic arenas, he had a lot more support than he may have had on his own on the squadrons.
Well, I write in the book, the chapter about when they're in Bonn. She spoke Bonnerisch German. She learned it very quickly. She spoke the local patois. Eric spoke Hochdeutsch. So, you know, Eric would ask, the equivalent would be, I say, fine fellow, can you direct me to the train station? And she'd say, where's the station? And I think that made a difference. But she charmed the German naval staff in 1956, 57, 58, 59, 60, that period, when Germany had come out of the horrors of the Second World War, reforming its armed forces, so vital to us in NATO. And the Germans were pretty proud people. You know, Hitler lost the war, not the Germans, was the sort of attitude that the German staff had. I think she did remarkably well. I used to really enjoy her company. She was about the same height as Eric, very bubbly, very effervescent. Go to the Hanover Air Show. This sticks in my mind. It's not in the book, but it absolutely sticks in my mind. ELA in Hanover. Must be about 84, 85. And MBB helicopters, Messerschmitt-Bockel-Blum helicopters, now part of Airbus, are hosting Eric because he was then the Helicopter Club of Great Britain, British Helicopter Advisory Board, FAI senior, all these good things. I mean, he was Mr. Helicopter. And I got invited along for various reasons. And Lynn goes, Paul, great. Now, we're going outside to watch Zimmermann fly. He's going to loop the Bolko. So we went outside to see Charlie Zimmermann do the most amazing flying display, which was great because that got me introduced to Charlie Zimmermann. I was a very junior reservist territorial officer in the Army Air Corps going through flying training to meet the great Zimmermann was fantastic. So I owe Lynn a lot as well. And I did enjoy her company. She would always allow me to open the champagne because we always had to have champagne when you went there. That was the other thing. I was talking just recently.
They sound like people after my own.
Yeah, you'd love them. Really. You'd love them. I mean, I was talking to Jenna Gearing, the sculptor who sculpted Winkle for both the National Gallery in Scotland and Fleet Air Arm Museum. And in fact, I have the resin cast of one of those on my desk. And Jenna said the thing that she, as a 21-year-old, you know, doing her very first commission as a sculptor, she's asked, you know, gin tonic or champagne before, almost before saying, would you like to sit down? She thought he was fab, and they were both charming. They were a power couple, we'd call them today. I mean, Lynn in the Second World War. It was the forces' favourite on the light service, I think it was called. Today we call that Radio 2, I think. The BBC in Northern Ireland doing forces' favourites, singing. So Lance Corporal O'Donovan wants to be remembered to his family in Belfast and wants to sing X. And so she would do the intro and then she'd sing the song. That got them actually to meet Glenn. To Glenn Miller. The whole of this Glenn Miller thing is actually not Eric, it's Lynn that does it. And she sang with the Glenn Miller band the night before Glenn Miller takes off or the last concert they do. It may not be exactly the night before, but just before he's killed. And Eric is so incredibly hurt by the fact that hang on, I'm the chief naval test pilot, I'm the one with the medals, I'm an ace, that he's allowed to play the second drums. And guess what I've got? I've got the drumsticks. So, you know, it's little things like that that I think are just fabulous.
The book is peppered with them, and it just it rounds out the man so much. And Lynn, I came away really wanting to have met Lynn.
I have to tell you, it seems he really disliked. Like, she was a better skier. I mean, she down here, you know, and where he was still, you know, sort of ploughing away, she was off and gone. And in a cocktail party, she had the most beautiful blonde hair, sparkling blue eyes, great personality, and a red dress. Fantastic. I can remember her being overawed by this. She was so confident, and she gave him confidence. And I think actually, she sort of starts to convert him from martinet, and there's all the hassle over the Helicopter Club of Great Britain and things like that, which I write about in the book. And then we get into the whole process of him retiring. What does he do? He's already been a bear with a sore head in 1970 when the Navy don't want him anymore. And, you know, they didn't want a lot of people then. It wasn't just picking him out. And then he gets to the end of the career. What's he going to do next? You know, well, might update Wings on My Sleeve, which I should say he didn't write. Kenneth Pullman was the author of that, the Admiralty author, which is in the book. And it was a propaganda book, propaganda story. But he, you know, once these myths are there, they've got to continue. So you'll see stuff on YouTube, and you'll see Eric, you'll see frickin' heck, you see Radio 4 Desert Island Discs. You know, I was born in Leith in 1919, he says. No, he wasn't, you know. The myths and legends, I can forgive all of that because it just makes the story more interesting. And he becomes a national treasure. And the thing that I loved about what he did, and I can see that from the letters which I've got, is the Bishop's Waltham, small little town in Hampshire, aviation group write to him and say, would you come? We've just formed. It's a sort of ad hoc group of 60 people. A lot of us are air traffic controllers from Shanwick. Not everyone's got military experience. Not everyone's a bit of pilot. In fact, very few are. But we have an aviation group. We meet once a month. Would you come and talk to us? And would you come and be our patron? So, of course, he said yes. And now we have a patron's night. I am now the patron of the Bishop's Waltham Aviation Group, sort of following on succession with Eric. It's fab. And I go and talk about Eric. And I go and just let them into yet something else that I've found out. You know, flying German jets. Of course, that's going to be so important this summer when the Messerschmitt 262 comes over from Germany. You know, we're going to be talking German jets again. Eric and the German jets. He flew at least seven of the 262s, including the two-seat night fighter version. There's only one left, and that's in South Africa now. He's a man that I thought in Wings on My Sleeve was two-dimensional. He's very much a three-dimensional man. He has a really strong character. And what I wanted to do was create a book that not just you and I, Matt, would read because we know who he is, but maybe some people who'd never heard of him will read and go, what an amazing guy. Do we make these people anymore? Where do we make this guy from? You know, how do we create this? In what country in the world? I suppose there are a few. America probably is an example.
You think I throw Canada in there.
Okay,
well.
Canada.
Throw me a bone.
Okay, yeah. Throw you a bone. Canada. sorry, where's Canada? No. Yeah. And you can go from being a foundling up to being the most famous pilot in the world. I mean, in what? It's less than 60 years. I mean, after 1970, he never flew again as pilot in command. He did a lot of flying. I mean, he flew with Airbus in the A380 to give them a hand with some trials. You know, more because I think they wanted just that other opinion of somebody else who'd had real issues taking an aircraft into the transition zone before you get to the speed of sound, things like that. Amazing. How amazing. What a privilege to have known him for so long. And to have eaten and drunk with him and been down the Duke's Head pub in Copthorne with him and introduced him to people. And then he introduced me to people. I mean, I wouldn't have known the Sikorsky family if it hadn't been, you know. And I spent a lot of time doing helis, you know, for Janes and for Helicopter World and things like that. Amazing.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we are at the Pima Air and Space Museum with one of our two Sikorsky Dragonflies. The Dragonfly was one of the first helicopters to go into service with the U.S. military, the Air Force, the Marines, and the Navy use them. This one was used by the Coast Guard. It was the first helicopter used by the Coast Guard. They were heavily used to kind of set up doctrine for search and rescue for the Coast Guard. So a lot of what went forward with more modern and powerful helicopters after this was all stuff that they learned using the Dragonfly. This one did do a stint on one of the Coast Guard icebreakers because they usually had helicopter support with those. It's interesting to take a look at these earlier helicopters that used World War II style piston engines. Like this one had a Pratt & Whitney R-98. So it limited a lot of the payload these types of helicopters could take. So it really was until you started having turbine engines in helicopters, like starting with helicopters like the Huey, that helicopters were actually able to start carrying larger amounts of troops and carry more equipment and more crew, weapons, etc. But this is one of the ones that started it all, like with the Bell and some of the other early helicopter designs.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And now, back to the show. One of the questions is, was it a relief when you were doing all the checks on the types and the landings and things like that, that they all did tally up? Because with some of the stories that sort of grew over time, those numbers adding up must have been, I don't want to say a relief, but must have been very concrete that he was taking very careful records while he was on the
line. So he did... The Guinness Book of Records does due diligence, and there was a lot of that. There was another Navy pilot, McWhirter, who was very, ironically, same name as the Guinness Book of Records twins, who was very close to him in numbers. The Americans tried to beat him. He used to say their pilot just couldn't cope with it. He had to go to a loony bin afterwards. I mean, Eric is the only non-American person in the Naval Aviation Hall of Fame. So, you know, that's a pretty good indicator, I think. And I thought, well, once you've found out that he's not a Scot, well, he is a Scot. I mean, crikey, he couldn't speak when he got to, he wasn't talking when he got to Edinburgh. Of course he's a Scot. He just isn't born a Scot. I don't actually think we can take the Scot bit away. We shouldn't take that away. Greatest Scotsman of the 20th century, absolutely.
Being married to a Scot, I would not dare to take his Scottish.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, he was very Scottish. Although being a lad from the borders, he wore trews and not that other thing that they wear. and he was very proud of being from the borders, from the Tweed. You know, wonderful valley. It's just such a lovely place. And it, pretty forthright about it. You know, Scotland should never be independent. It is part of the United Kingdom. You know, all of that. Very, very forthright about that. But I just thought he was, he could be, I saw him go from irascible to national treasure, I suppose. I got a couple of things wrong once in a discussion with him about P-1154 and P-1127, Harrier and supersonic Harrier, if you like. And he was quite firm, a Navy captain, in putting me back in my box, but with a smile. And you know, there's some lovely anecdotes in the book about him at Lossiemouth and with his son Glenn, which I think are really good. I don't really give too much away. I want people to buy the book. For goodness.
Of course, yeah.
But what I love about what Penguins allowed me to do is put 100 pictures in. So, you know, there are colour plates after colour plates. And what they've allowed me to do is where I had to edit out some little anecdotes, they're back in as captions to the photographs. So that was a really good compromise we got to. The book could have been twice as long. It could easily have been 1,000 pages about Eric Brown, because his life is just so, so remarkable, Matt. I mean, where's the new Eric Brown out there? I'm not sure. You know, how do you become chief naval test pilot as an acting lieutenant, Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve Air Branch? You know, that's okay. You know, Eric and I had the same rank for one time. I flirted with the Navy, and I think I was a probationary temporary acting sub lieutenant at some stage. Well, he was that, but he'd just been before that a rating pilot. And then afterwards he became a probationary acting sub-lieutenant, which he kept for about 3 years. He could have been promoted quicker had he have not done a few things which caused their lordship's displeasure. And that was one of the wonderful things about reading his S206, where the, oh my God, did take away without aircraft without permission. Did cause a hurricane to catch fire, did low-level aerobatics without permission, you know, grounded for 2 weeks. Thank goodness he was, otherwise he would never have been able to court Lynn. I mean, that was a marriage made in heaven, you know. First girlfriend, married, you know, she died in 1998. I mean, fantastic.
And I think that's what comes across really well. I'm looking forward to the final version because I've got the one without the pictures.
Ah,
yeah. And so I'm looking forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, 8th of June, the Royal Aeronautical Society. Yep. Absolutely.
And the thing that point you just made there came across was the fact he was a bit of a boy really made me happy that. Some of the things that he didn't talk so willingly about, the naughtiness that the grabbing things, which explains the, you know, the Saunders Row incident as well, that, yeah, if he fancied taking something up or doing something, he just did it. And I really like that about him.
But, I love the fact that in 1945, he goes into the Russian zone in Germany with some cigarettes and says to the guys, not only do they have some German aircraft, they have a Focke-Wulf 187 there, which he wanted to fly. But they also had a Yak 3. You know, kind of go and fly that. It's not authorized. Pack of cigarettes. I've done the same. 1992 Sikorsky in Russia. Can I look inside the MiG-31? Not authorized. 200 Marlboro. Authorized. And the same thing. I mean, I just think it's very good. He's always prepared, you see. When you're a test pilot, you need to be prepared for the what you don't expect to happen. So means of escape. I mean, they used to drum this into me with my flying. Two means of escape. No, walk into a room. Two means of escape. In case there's a fire. Know how you can get out. He used to practice rolling into a ball. When he was 93, 92, 93, he had a car accident. A lorry backed into his car. He had a Peugeot 308 sports car. He liked sports cars. He'd just got his first speeding ticket. And Laurie backed into the car on the driver's side. And when the police who were passing ran over, the one constable apparently said to the other, "He's a goner," because the driver's side was absolutely collapsed. The passenger well was Eric, curled up in the fetal position, in the brace, all the impact taken, no ill effects. How about that? How about that?
That's amazing. The time again, time and time again, when his shortness of stature saved him. The nickname Winkle is because he's short, and of course
Periwinkle.
Periwinkle. Yeah. Mm.
An American asked me why we would give such a horrible American woman, why such a horrible nickname to our greatest pilot. And I had to explain it was Periwinkle. It's nothing to do with anything in the
in the other
ages. I just thought Goth's Struth saved me. The fact that he was short enough to fit into things, cockpits, BF-109, Rado. Actually, Rado had quite a bit of space, really, in the early Spitfires. The Seafire, definitely. I mean, you've been in a Spitfire cockpit. There's not a lot of room.
It's not built for someone of my girth and height.
He was perfect. But actually, he wasn't that tall. Wasn't that out of place? I mean, it wasn't that short for his time. If you look at his, there's a picture in the book of some of his squadron mates. I've been able to, the photographs have been in his album, and I've been trying to identify them. Then I did a book about the Fleet Army of the Battle of Britain, and I suddenly realized I could recognize the faces from that, and I've been able to identify them all. They're all about the same, 5'6", 5'7". He used to say he was 5'7". His naval record said something different.
Yeah. I interviewed a stealth fighter pilot recently who's too tall to be a United States Air Force pilot. And he just said, "You learn how to slouch."
Yeah.
And you know the regs. So it works both ways. You either stand tall or you hunker yourself down a little
bit. I recommend Argentine Tango to anyone who wants to be taller, because if you don't stand, I'm leaning to talk to you. If you don't do that, I've gone up 2 centimeters since I've been dancing.
I suffer from an acute lack of rhythm, so my tango days are not going to happen, I'm afraid. Much to my wife's annoyance, I'm sure she'll get me doing one of these things.
Give her my number.
I have to say that I was a bit sad when I finished the book, so I wanted to spend more time with him. And knowing that you probably could have done another volume is bugging me now, because I finished it off on a flight to New York, and I just remember finishing it and thinking, I miss him.
That's lovely.
And it must have been lovely for you to spend these years after Eric's passing to get to know him a little bit better.
I think I probably got to know him in the period before I met him. 1978-ish, I think I met him. I corresponded with him. And typical Eric, I corresponded a couple of times, and he went, "I think it's best if we discuss this over lunch, dear boy. I'm in Surrey. You know where I am. Give me a call." So I gave him a call, and he said, "Right, okay, lunch on Sunday then." "Are you free on Sunday?" "Lunch on Sunday." So Beaver dutifully troops over, and lunch turns into afternoon and evening, and lo and behold, there arrive a whole bunch of hoods. Sergei Sikorsky, for example, the son of Igor, and a few others. It becomes a bit of a really good shindig. And how lovely that was. I didn't look back. But actually, to do the research on Eric, Eric, 1930s Eric, getting his school diary, boy, was he busy. He was, you name the game, he played it. He played snooker, he played cricket, he played rugby. He didn't play that ridiculous game, the 22 players, where they all fall on the floor and go, ow, and I paid far too much money. He played proper games. And he was runner-up ducks of the school. He was top of his class in many things. Actually, his French was better than his German, but his French sort of decayed with the lack of use, and German, his German was, was then better. And who he didn't know in the old Germany was fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So, and of course, we've not talked about, I could have done at least two chapters worth on Hannah Reich and his relationship with her. There she is.
I was going to ask about Hannah, because that's a very, I don't want to say straight, I'll say interesting relationship there, because she was an interesting woman. And
strange woman. I mean,
fascination with her was something else.
So I've got a huge file, sort of, you know, at least that thick, on Hannah, letters and stuff. The one thing there is not is the copy of the last letter she wrote to him before she committed suicide, which he sent to her brother and didn't keep a copy of, which I regret very much, because I'd like to have read that. And I think, you know, other people would have done as well. But, you know, he had this, you know, he thought she was an amazing aviatrix. I mean, there she was, all these gliding records in 1930s, you know, age 21, distance record from Friedrichshafen down the spine of Italy and back again, things like that. People, you know, a really good pilot, a handling pilot like Eric. You know, not like Melita von Stauffenberg, who was an excellent test pilot, but she was an engineering test pilot. Everything to her was worked out in engineering terms. You know, Claire Mully's book really separates the two. But Eric never met Melita, which I think is a pity, because Eric, although he was an arts grad or arts undergrad, because he didn't actually graduate until he got a war graduation in 1947, but he picked up engineering pretty quickly. And I suppose he had to, you know, to survive. Yeah. He used to spend his, I mean, when he was at Farnborough, 44 to 49, 5 years at Farnborough, he rarely took leave. He would do a bit of sport every now and then, play rugby. But he would then spend his time with the Boffins. And I wish I had some of the stuff that they talked about. I mean, I wish I had the plan form for Concorde drawn on a cigarette packet in building 379 or whatever it was at Farnborough, or the Vulcan wing shape, all coming from Germany, of course. And I think his admiration for German technology and his admiration for the bravery of individual Germans like Hannah Reich. You know, Hannah Reich flew a V1. A manned V1 to see what the problems were with the gyro. Potty. I think he admired that. He couldn't cope with her adoration for Adolf Hitler. I don't suppose any of us can, actually, to be honest. It is strange, but it doesn't take away Hannah's abilities. Flew the first woman to fly a helicopter inside the Deutsche Halle, which he saw. You know, he was there at the right time, the right place. He saw the first British jet fly by just having a weather diversion into Cranwell. You know, and luck plays a huge part in aviation, and in surviving in aviation, that's always the key.
Yeah, it's you could see in, especially the way you form and. The relationship they had, that mutual respect, and I guess for him as well, having been in Germany in those sort of formative years of Nazi rule as well, that must have been a very interesting conversation he was having with himself while he was talking to Hannah about that, how she never reconciled with the fall or the realities of it.
Absolutely right. I mean, he I think it's key. Like the country, the language, ironically, the cuisine, some of the wines, which I can agree with him, the Moselles, for example. Not so much the
beer. That was my holiday last summer.
Not so much the beers.
Moselle Valleys.
So, you know, it's good stuff. Didn't like the political bit. You know, couldn't understand it. You know, until the Second World War, you know, like the fact the trains ran on time and the autobahns and all of it, because you could just see that. All you see in Berlin, all you saw in Berlin in 38, 39 period was just a success story. It would today be like going to Beijing. I think then going back, I mean, he first went back to Berlin about 10 years after the war, and he was really surprised at the devastation, really shocked by the devastation. But he went back and, you know, he just said, well, the system has weeded out the Nazis. The German military that are left are German military, just like me, a patriot for your country. Your country needs you. You go and be a submarine commander. So he met the submarine commander who'd sunk Audacity, his aircraft carrier, you know, and killed some of his mates. But that's war. The parallels are huge, aren't they? It still happens. You know, there are still, between Argentina and Britain, 41 years after the Falklands, there are still people who meet and talk and discuss. You know, there are... and there will be more of this from Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm sure. It's human nature. Because if you're a professional airman, you want to talk, or professional sailor, and Eric was very much a sailor, a flying sailor, you want to talk to the people. You want to talk to your own. I mean, I know this from having done a Russian pilot's license when I had a yak in the 90s, going to do a Russian pilot's license in Russia. My Russian was good enough. Their English was almost good enough. I succeeded. I didn't kill anyone. But we then spent 5 hours talking about aeroplanes with not really a lot in common, except we were able to do it. There's a lot of this going on. But we're all pilots. It's great.
And it's understanding that experience. This is, you know, when you get to sitting on those conversations, this is what I saw. What was it like from your side? It was understanding what the reverse is.
I think that's really relevant. I mean, I think that's he did a lot to bring the Luftwaffe and the Marine Flieger into the system properly. If you see in the book, you know, I cite some of his reports. You know, he would have made a great diplomat, and certainly when he went to Bonn as naval attaché, he did a lot of really good work there, especially when Her Majesty the Queen went on state visit, just helping out with that. There's some pictures in the book of that, which you haven't seen yet, I know.
I'm really looking forward to that. I think that's enough teasing. People, go out, buy the book. It's fantastic. And
I hope they will. I hope they come. We're going to do a few launches, one in London at the 8th of June, which is a free event. I just hope you buy the book. Talk Valley History Festival, the Army Flying Museum. I want to go to Scotland and take the book up there because good burghers of Galashiels need to know about their man and those in Edinburgh, the Royal High School, etc. So a lot going on. I'm on Twitter, which is probably the place to find out where I'm going to be. So at Beaver Westminster. So that's me.
What I'll do, I shall put the Troc Valley event, your Twitter, all those things in the description.
That'd be lovely.
For the pod, so people can.
Thank you.
Paul, it's always a delight and I love the book. Thank you for spending some time with me.
Huge pleasure. I'm very happy.
Wingull, The Extraordinary Life of Britain's Greatest Pilot, is out today if you're listening to this on their release, which is the 8th of June. As we were talking about in the pod, Paul's going to be doing lots of events coming up, including at the Troc Valley History Festival, which is a fabulous event, and I'll put the link to his talk in there below. Link to our bookshop where you can pick up a copy, support the pod. There'll be a link to Paul's Twitter and all the other good things in the description to this podcast as well. As always, thank you for your continued support of the show. Tell your friends, leave some reviews, join us on Patreon if you want to. You get these things early, no ads, which are always great. And I just tell your friends, the numbers are going up, which is nice. But we can always have more. And we've got some fantastic stuff coming up. We have a reunion for the Radio 4 adaptation of Len Deighton's Bomber. We've got next week, we've got Tom Whipple from The Times telling us about his book, The Battle of the Beams, and lots more besides, including those episodes about the 8th Air Force, which I'm sitting on until Masters of the Air finally shows. Hopefully that'll be soon. Until next time, please do take care of yourselves. Thanks for listening and have a great week. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.